In today's Medea Vox, we discuss digital parenting and how social media platforms can become spaces for pushing the boundaries of being normal. I'm Hugo Boothby, a lecturer in communication for development, and I'm joined today by Pille Prulman-Wengefeldt. Pille is a professor in media and communication studies, and we both work here in the School of Arts and Communication at Malmö University. Pille is also the mother of a child with CHARGE syndrome, and in her current work, she researches how parents use Facebook groups to support children with disabilities. Welcome to Medea Vox. Pille, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've been an enthusiastic user of online technology since the mid-90s, so you're quite an early adopter.
I am, actually. My very first internet uses were when I was in my teenage years. And then internet was consisting of text-based computers with black background and green or yellow text. And I was playing multi-user dungeon games. So that was part of my growing up. And that became also part of my academic career, in a sense that in the early days, there was a lot of moral panic and, oh my God, internet's gonna either destroy our identities or it's going to bring the democracy to the world. And my personal experience to both of those claims was, nah, that's not really how things are going. So I was thinking, okay, if my experience is saying something different, maybe it's also someone else's experience that doesn't really conform to the existing two polarizing ways of presenting yourself on the internet or internet around you. So that was my bachelor thesis paper, actually. I thought, I'm going to just investigate this. I was looking at group norms in chat rooms because I felt that it didn't really go for democracy all around, and it didn't really go for me losing totally my identity, because at that time I had my best friends from the on those groups and my first boyfriends and things like that. So that was this kind of part of me growing up or having my formative teenage years in those chat rooms and in those environments. So, of course, that was carried through also to my parenthood. So when I first became a mother in 2005, my in-laws and my mother and father, they had come to visit us on this special occasion of baby coming home from the hospital. And we had thought, okay, we're going to be this totally ecological parents. We're going to do nappies that are washable. Like, we're not going to go for Pampers or anything other brand named paper diapers, because we know that's not really healthy for your baby boys. So we had bought these nappies from the internet. And of course, then we had this newborn at our house and we're thinking, oh my God, what do we do? And then we Googled the site for where we got those things to get folding instructions. And then I was going downstairs and I saw my mother being a bit upset about this. Yeah, but we did cloth nappies when you were a kid. Like, couldn't you come down and ask? So that was, I really honestly hadn't thought about it. I thought, okay, I bought those from the internet. I'm going to get the instructions and knowledge also from the internet. So that was sort of my earliest digital parenting moments, where my sort of cloth nappies that would have actually needed to connect me back to my parents were also marking my being a digital mum the first time.
And as your academic career progressed and your family grew, and you've got three children, how did your relationship with online communities change when your third child was born?
So the time when my third child was born was very, it was on the one hand filled with expectations that, okay, we've got two boys already, the third's going to be a boy, we know what we're doing. I had really great expectations on myself and the family, because, yeah, the first two, they had slept well, they had eaten well, they were quite a sort of, one could say, easy baby. So I knew that the third one's going to be born somewhere in April, and then we're going to fly to a conference. I was a main organizer of a small one-day conference in another country. I'm just going to take, my husband's going to take holidays, and we're going to be like this idyllic academic family. I have a wrap that's going to just go and allow me to take my baby with me. And I was not thinking that academia is, I don't know, inclusive or exclusive for babies. So that wasn't even on my agenda. Because that was, I'm going to make my own space. But then when, instead of April, the baby was born in the middle of February. It was 6 weeks earlier than planned. And I was on the in the delivery room and calling my colleague saying, you know that class I had to teach? I really have to cancel that because now I'm giving birth and actually, you know, cancel the whole week of classes and meetings I've had because it was my last week at work that I thought I'm just going to take care of everything before going on leave. An hour later after that telephone call, the baby was born and was whisked out of the delivery room to a nearby medical room where doctors were trying to save his life to get him breathing because apparently his nostrils both were blocked from behind. And because one of the things that doctors do when you get a baby who doesn't breathe, they intubate, and that sort of put a tube into the baby to make the air go also in. But they usually try to go through nose because that's the sort of way the air goes in. And this particular baby didn't have nostrils that you could intubate. Or he had nostrils, but he had blocked nose passages. That was the first indication, okay, something's really wrong. So I was recuperating, and my husband followed the baby to the nearby children's hospital, and they didn't really know what's wrong with him. So there was a lot of, we just sort of wait and see, and also, okay, blocked nostrils, this we can fix. We just operate. And so his first operation when he was 2 days old, a team of specialist doctors were later complaining, yeah, he's so small. Because of course the newborn baby, especially premature newborn baby, is small to operate. But they managed to create extra nasal passages and air was flowing through and we were good to go. But then this didn't really work out. It started growing back and all that kind of stuff was starting happening. And then we were going day in, day out hospital and new diagnosis. At some point, it felt daily. Every time we went to the hospital, there was a new diagnosis. It was quite tough until we got a preliminary diagnosis of the CHARGE syndrome. Of course, any new diagnosis that we had, a digital mother that I was, home, Googling, internet forums, but also medical literature as much as I could. For instance, those blocked nostrils, they're called corneal atresia. What's the common practice? What's the outcome? What's the prognosis? All that was sort of on my reading list. So when the CHARGE syndrome diagnosis came, it was almost a relief because it gave everyone a checklist. What's more to come? And that also gave me access to both a American-based foundation with a handbook for new parents where every next diagnosis has a new page, and that's a hell of a lot of pages in that handbook. And also access to a Facebook group that unites mothers mostly, or mothers and of course fathers as well, but parents mostly from US, but also from outside, and that openly discussed children with the same diagnosis from all walks of life and from almost all continents.
Can you just describe what CHARGE syndrome is?
So, syndrome for medical language. It's a time when different diagnoses are together. So syndrome is not necessarily the one, there is a one main cause and the others are all sort of related to it, but it's a group of different diagnoses that occurs together and oftentimes has genetical background. So as in CHARGE, 2/3 of the cases of people who get CHARGE diagnosis have a mutation in what is called CDH7 gene. They're not sure if this is the only one, but this is one that I've so far found. And that's a gene that supports a production of a protein when the baby is still a fetus. That protein dictates building of the body. When that protein is not produced enough, the building of the body remains ever so slightly unfinished. And that particular protein dictates everything to do around the face and upper body area. So the stuff that can be unfinished, and in case of CHARGE syndrome, it's also a acronym for different kind of coexisting things. So C is for conal atresia, that's the blocked nose thing. H is for different kind of, oh sorry, C is for coloboma, it's actually for eyes, that there is visual impairment up till, from perfect sight to blindness. H is for heart problems. A is for atresia, and that can be the blocked noses, but it actually can also be a blocked food passages. Then is the R for, because again, this is the syndrome was first founded in late 70s, early 80s. It's retardation. So it's actually for the fact that children with CHARGE are often late in their development. And that's, at that time was called, they were just retarded. G is for genitals. And E is for ears. So anything to do with ears, for starting from how they look from outside, but often also how they're built from inside, can be missing or malformed or formed differently based on the traditional practice. So that's the typical sort of list of things. And there is a, nowadays they also have additional ways of defining what CHARGE is, but this is the sort of most common things. And all of these have then a potential of how often they occur in the population with people with CHARGE. So ear malformations occur almost on all the children, some kind of malformations, whereas colobomas in the eyes are about like 70 to 80%. So there's very, very huge differences in that sense. But they do share a certain facial features. And then, of course, genetics are very wary of giving facial features a specific definition. But if you look, for instance, at the pictures of those children, you can see it's sort of resemblance. So that was one of those moments for me in the Facebook group where I found a boy who's living in England and is about the same age as my youngest. Oh my God, they could be twins. They're like so alike that they are absolutely star-crossed twins. They have about 2 or 3 months in age apart. They have slightly different health problems and challenges, but they look like... they look like they would belong in the same family.
It's very interesting for me to talk to you about your family and about CHARGE. And I think it's particularly interesting because we work quite closely together, but this is, it's not something that we've talked about socially. And it's something that I've come to understand about you and your life through your work, because you've chosen to take this as an area of research within media and communication studies. And I just wondered how you came to that decision to start to research something which was involved in your personal and family life.
So, first of all, I don't think in the beginning it was any conscious decision that, oh, this is going to be a research project. But it was a way for me to maintain some sort of me and some sort of my own identity in that chaos of the hospitals and tubes and machines and going there day in, day out, not knowing if you have a child in the evening or in the morning. But then I was thinking, I'm a professional communication researcher. And a lot of that first about 6 months was about communication for me. It was very much about communication with the doctors. It was a lot about learning the medical lingo. So the research project that I was thinking in my head, I actually, because there's a lot of waiting in that time, and there's a lot of just sitting next to the cot or a crib of a baby who's sleeping, and you're doing, okay, what am I doing? And then in my head, I was planning a research project because that was my sort of salvation to a certain extent. That was my sanity point. But that research project was actually something quite different. That was about medical communication. That was about how we can improve that. And that research project, I gave away to a certain extent because it turned out that in the hospital where we were living at that time, one of my husband's relatives, kind of distant relative, she was a nurse in the intensive care unit, and she was ambitious and wanted to do something else as well. And I was like, yeah, but why don't you go and do a master's degree in the communications program? That would be an interesting combination, and you could definitely bring something valuable back. And so she ended up doing a master's project around communication with parents who have long-term disabled children in the intensive care, and about their experiences, how do they get the medical communication and all that. So that was, I was happy that I could give it away for someone else, because that was at that time way too personal, way too intensive. I didn't have any ability to really distance myself from that. So that wasn't a project at all. I was putting that aside, and that was a mental game for me to keep sanity. But then a few years later, there was this call for papers to a project about digital parenting. And in that long list of topics that they thought one could do was digital parenting to disabled children. And I thought, okay, if that's not for me, if that's not something that where I can put my experiences as a communications professor and my experiences as a disabled mother together into a research project, like what else could I do? And that was my idea, that I'm going to do this project. I'm going to, in that project, reflect about my journey as a digital parent. And it was a really, really difficult struggle to find the right angle. Because then I was realizing, okay, by that time, a bit more than 4 years, I had been parent to this great kid. I was thinking, okay, how do I make that story into a research paper? Because that's also the question about, or challenge about that, is lived experiences are so rich and so nuanced, whereas research papers are, this particular one is 4,000 words. So how do I compress this lived experience to a very specific and very narrow academic format? So that was my first attempt in that kind of academic work in general.
After you'd come out of hospital, your interest in your use of online media started to come to the fore again. Could you talk about the research that you've been doing, and what are those things that you've discovered which have been most interesting to you?
The Facebook groups were there actually already when the kid was in hospital, because that became also, as I said, the kind of planning of a research project became an academic lifeline, and the first Facebook groups became then the kind of personal lifeline, because they were the ones showing there is hope and there is future and there are other people living with that syndrome and having life. But then when I was trying to sort of summarize that into some kind of academic research, I ended up turning myself to the concept of affordances. And affordances is, to me, actually quite a new concept, because it's very closely connected to design research. And I only encountered design research to this extent here in Malmö University, because my previous work has been mostly around audiences and museums. So when I was first kind of emerged from my I'm a mother of disabled kid hospital life cycle, I actually turned more towards museums and information offering and communication. And I had the medical communication somewhere in the back of my head, but not as a sort of active thing. So the affordances came as a way of making sense in my experiences of the Facebook group. Because affordances are a way of explaining the idea that when designer designs, and again, the most easiest, most classic example is when a designer designs a door, and if the door has a handle, that handle needs to be pressed and pulled or pressed and pushed. And majority of people recognize that the handle is meant for use with hand, for instance, instead of leg or head or other parts of the body. And that the handle prescribes a certain kind of action. So if there is no handle, then you're assuming that that door needs to be pushed instead of pulled. But the prescription of what do you do with that object needs also to be recognized by the person. So affordances is a combination of designerly intention and audience recognition. And that was most fascinating for me, because as an audience researcher, this was kind of the missing link in my understanding. So one thing is that what Facebook is designed for, and we can argue that Facebook design has changed over time, and it has also been sort of adapted to many different kind of things, and there are constantly subtle changes in Facebook design as well. But at the same time, how then a group of parents with disabled children, how do they then utilize that design for their cause? In that case, cause for networking and cause for seeing each other's children. That was a way to adjust Facebook's affordances to their purpose.
Can I just ask you then, how were people using Facebook? How are you using Facebook?
So to focus on this particular case of charged parenting, the Facebook has a very strong visual component to it. So a lot about in this closed Facebook group is about sharing images of those children. And sharing those images makes several kinds of senses. So first of all, it's about shared identity. It's about understanding who am I as a parent, but also who is my child, and recognizing that the child is not, in a bad way, a freak in the country show, but it's a person who belongs to a community of like-looking, but also like-minded people. It's about sharing relief through narratives, because that's a place where you can sort of share those stories. And it's about sharing understanding, because when you then post, for instance, a picture or a short video or a celebratory moment, my four-year-old finally started walking. In many other communities, it would be like, what, so late? Where were you? Where are the doctors? What are you doing or what are you not doing? Whereas here, everyone in that group, everyone would cheer you on, say, well done, because everyone recognizes that walking is one of those challenges with children with missing balance organs that they need to master. But it's also very often that they master that through that shared, they just take their own time. Or that when a new baby is born and a mother with full of chaos and panic posts, thank you for allowing me into this group. This is my new baby. This is what's wrong with her. Basically begging, give me some hope. Then she's flooded with encouragements, compliments on the way baby looks, even if the baby would be outside the traditional normal of beautiful. But Everyone just sees how gorgeous these children are, and the encouragement through the fact that these children are strong fighters, and this is my kid, now 3, 4, 24, giving the mother hope that there is future.
And I remember you saying that pictures of birthday celebrations have particular resonance in the group.
Pictures of birthday celebrations are, of course, something that any almost any digital mother would share. There is this discussion about protecting your child's privacy and is it okay? And but then if you're sharing that group a picture of a child, for instance, turning one, it's a huge thing because of the fact that quite old data, but about 30% of those children die before they reach age one, which means that if you've reached age one, you've conquered the hardest year of your life. The second stage is the second sort of cutoff point is age five. So after age five, you're almost out of the woods in terms of the mortality rate drops again significantly. So if you've lived until five, then you're having much, much higher chances of living to a fulfilling adulthood. So any kind of those pictures is a celebration of a milestone, but also celebration of we've survived it. Celebration of survival, which I don't think any other, or not any other, but for an ordinarily healthy one-year-old mother is not celebrating survival with a one-year-old picture. But this charge group definitely is.
And I know that sometimes parents in the group also, they share moments of great happiness, but also moments of great sadness. How did you experience that as a charge parent?
These are, of course, the most difficult ones. These are the most difficult posts to see and most difficult posts to react because oftentimes they're one of those major organs that gets impacted is a heart. And an early life heart failure is something that is one of those major causes that takes away these children very early. There is this shared sorrow, shared recognition, and also shared understanding that this could be me. Again, much more closely than in any other situations. Of course, any parent hearing a child, even a strange child, death, accident, it hurts us. But this is a sort of much more intensive exposure to that kind of hurt. And that's heartbreaking. But at the same time, I'm also thinking that's, for those parents, often probably the way of consolidation. They know that these people will support them. They will be there. They will be sometimes even giving financial support for funerals and because it's an American group, hospital bills, which will follow you, unfortunately, also after this kind of situations. So it's about holding together, but also a lot of parents actually stay on in that group even after a child has passed away. So they don't leave that because they feel that this is their way of connecting to their passed away children.
And the reason that we're talking about these things, which are kind of emotional, is because this is part of an important academic project. And one of the things that you're interested in is how this group challenges norms. And I just wondered, how do you understand that concept of normativity, and how is this Facebook group connected to that?
So the concept of normativity is, of course, there is a very simple sort of psychology-inspired definition of what is normal. It is the what is average, and then it's two times the standard deviation away from that average is still normal. And if you're more than two times away, then it becomes not average anymore, not normal anymore. So you have normal intelligence, and then you have, of course, intelligence that's above normal, and then you have intelligence that's below normal. But then you have a normal age of starting to walk or normal age of doing things. And then, of course, as a parent, you're constantly confronted with that normal. You have parenting handbooks, or you have the doctor's meetings, and they all are using those norms partially also to detect problems. So that's about, for instance, if your child is not walking or talking, deviating from normal is a point of concern. that's where you need to intervene. That's where you need to help. So in that sense, the norm is used for good things. It's used to rescue, to make sure that no one's left behind. At the same time, the normal is also used then for in other social situations, for different kind of self-judgment. Am I a good enough parent? Am I a normal parent? And are my children following the normal developmental curves and everything? And then, of course, when you have a child with great medical concerns and all those challenges, in that way, they're not normal, because they fall out of that normal curves in many of the aspects. They are often later to walk, they are later to talk, or if they ever gonna talk at all, because a lot of them are deaf and therefore the language development is seriously hindered. They are later to grasp on their academic knowledges, because again, if you're fighting to stay alive, you really don't have that much energy left to do other things. And in that group of Facebook, in this particular case, the parents are then making, through sharing those posts, they are making a space for alternative normal. They are making, if someone then comes and says, okay, my baby is 8 months old and still not turning, again, in the traditional medical system, that would be a cause for great concerns. Here, a lot of parents would just totally calmly say, as long as she or he is getting physiotherapy to support their muscle development and you're sort of supporting them on their journey, if they don't turn on 8 months, maybe they'll turn on 9, or maybe they'll turn on 12 months. That's the sort of much more acceptance of the diversity of humanity. So the parents, through sharing those experiences, they are creating this space where different kind of abilities or different kind of developmental stages are also recognized as part of the new normal or charged normal in this case.
I mean, can you give an example of a post or some kind of something that happened within the group which you think is a good example of how these norms are being challenged?
So there are the posts where, again, celebrate developmental milestones, which, for instance, I remember very vividly in very early on when we had just gotten the news that our kid doesn't have much balance organs. And there was a short video of a girl who was, and I even can't remember whether she was 5 or 9, but she was mastering stairs. She was coming down the stairs all by herself. And the proud mummy moment at that post was, who needs those balance organs anyway? And that for me was saying, yeah, okay, the balance organs are of course very important and very necessary, but there is a possibility to have self-coping mechanisms that support even life without balance organs. So that would be one way of sort of saying, yeah, alternative normal is also okay. But the other way is also saying, okay, you know, society, make space for our differently able children into your normality. In my opinion, that's sort of the best examples of these things are Halloween posts. Halloween is such a big holiday in America, and it's of course not really part of my everyday European normal. Yeah, Halloween is, but it's more of a movie stuff. But then, of course, in US, if you're out of Halloween, I don't know if you're actually able to exist in the society without being part of the Halloween. But then how do you make a costume to a child who sits in the wheelchair? And then creative parents are rocking the whole idea of making fire engines or superhero costumes that are adapting or that are taking advantage of the fact that there is a wheelchair. So they're not making a costume of their child as a disabled person, but they are making their costumes that allows their child to be center of their attention with probably the coolest costume on the block, thanks to their wheelchair or thanks to that adaptations. And then the other ways, again, connected to Halloween, which I haven't seen myself, but I've experienced through Facebook group again, is that a lot of those charged children, they can't eat orally because their swallow function is just not developed enough often. And of course, Halloween is a candy-oriented party in the US. And that a lot of times what kids get is candy on top of candy. And how do you then sort of celebrate those kids who don't have the ability to eat candy but still would want to be part of the deal? So apparently you can put out a pumpkin instead of the traditional orange, you can put out a purple pumpkin, marking that in this household, different children are recognized and accepted, and treats, also non-edible treats, are given out so that if a child is not an eating person, they can still get a treat that brings joy and pleasure, but is not meant for eating. They get a small toy or a glow stick or something like that that's sort of fun and in the holiday spirits, but it's addressing the same thing differently.
And these kind of very practical, concrete sort of things that people share and the stories they share and challenging norms in this way, how does this help us think differently about society in general and the way we understand people who have impairments or different abilities? How does this connect to broader questions of citizenship and participation?
I think this is a small act of participation that that people do in creating space around themselves first and foremost. It is also about a lot of times recognition that often people, they don't want to purposefully exclude anyone, but would you have thought about giving candy at a Halloween as an excluding practice if I hadn't told you the story? Because we are so ingrained in our own abilities and in our own normal that we don't necessarily know about the challenges that our normal generates to others. So for instance, if we're building a new house, doing two steps of stairs to get into the door, it doesn't really occur to us that it's a excluding practice unless we've been sitting in a wheelchair, having a mobility impaired person with us, or even going out with a buggy. And having a ramp there instead of those two stairs most of the time doesn't cost anything else than a little bit of effort in thinking differently. I think that's part of what Facebook allows to, in this case, is to generate awareness, and sometimes also to generate awareness that the abilities to address these issues sometimes are really, really small. But then, of course, there are moments when they are more expensive or more demanding on the society in general. But then it's a moment for us as a society to reflect, okay, what do we win when we manage to include these people in a meaningful way? Or what do we win when we systematically exclude them? In a sense that there are practices in the olden times where, yeah, disabled people in a Sparta environment just got cast away from the cliff. Probably very cheap practice for the society, but not as cheap practice for the individual. So how do we balance this costs and benefits as a society between remaining able body focused or broadening our perspectives?
I'm also really interested in your practice as an academic, because as you said previously, you had a background in audience studies and researching public spaces like museums, although you continued this kind of long-term interest in online cultures. But you describe your method here for this work as an auto-ethnography. And I just wondered, what does this kind of method offer you that you wouldn't get from a more traditional audience studies method?
Auto-ethnography, now that I come to think about it, has been with me actually much longer than my conscious thought about that. When I told you about my sort of beginning of my research career as a inspiration, my experiences were different, and therefore I felt that I needed to investigate into other experiences as well in order to get that diversity into academic literature. So that was my very first sort of mid-90s, late-90s starting point for doing research in general. At that time, I didn't have a label for it. I didn't know that this was a sort of autoethnography inspired, because again, there it was more of an inspiration to turn towards more conventional methods like interviews or text analysis or surveys. In this particular case, I felt that the subject is so sensitive. The community is so few and far in between. So until this March, I only knew of one other family who had a child with a similar syndrome. I had never met any other children before sort of moving to Sweden. In that sense, it was a question also about access to the data. So how could I get those experiences if I don't know anyone, or if I don't get anyone to talk to me? On the other hand, it was this realization that my very emotional, personal experience through my lens as an academic, through my research, literature, knowledge, I could turn into what I hope is a powerful and empowerment piece of research because I have these unique insights. And I was just thinking, if someone would ask me in an interview to make sense of those pictures, for instance, even those birthday pictures, I don't think it would occur to me to make those connections during an interview, because that's a sort of short-term encounter. But that realization that this is the celebration of life has only come to me through seeing literally hundreds of them over long period of time and being connected to the theoretical lens. I don't think this kind of research, and this is not only sort of this particular research, but some research in general, because of the emotional and affective nature of it, I don't think all of it can be done using conventional research methods, which distance yourself from the research subject or from the object of inquiry.
Because a lot of research into online cultures kind of prioritizes articulations of voice and self-expression. But I wonder, has researching in this way helped you understand better other forms of co-creation or participation?
I think that's also part of my earliest internet research days, the frustration of the fact that the internet research and the social media research is so obsessed about the opportunity of co-creation. It's the fact that one can be both the user and producer, and it's the coining of the term producer, and it's because of those traces that people leave in the internet space that makes the whole space so appealing to researchers. Because suddenly, for instance, we could study interaction in those chat room situations in a much more different way than we could study interaction previously, where it was just a fleeting conversation. But that focus drew, I think, the attention of all the researchers into those active communicators. And that active communicator is very important part of the digital world. But at the same time, the active communicator is not everyone. And so my own research in that charge community was also inspired by the fact that I felt that I was not necessarily part of that community of charge parents, because the whole idea of community implied much more stronger and closer relationships. I was there as a lurker. I felt at least some distance from the whole group. Yet when I look at my own practice, I liked and hate many of those. I posted many congratulations to those birthday pictures and even initiated one or two posts myself, in addition to sort of responding to some of explicit questions or comments that I felt that I was. And only when writing this article, I was starting to reflect about this kind of, okay, am I now actively part of this group or not? And if we label this group as a community, do I feel more excluded or more included in that? And again, as often with research, the actual process of writing or the actual process of sense making highlights new dimensions about also yourself that you never really thought about that. So this has been a most enlightening project also to my own self-reflection, because it has shown me that some of those things that we think that we can capture with interview questions or survey questions, we can't really, because of that not really clear way of being to that we can in articulating our own behavior. I don't know if you would ask me sort of, do you participate in that community regularly or irregularly? Or even if you'd ask that in the open question, it would take me some time to answer that. And it would take you some more time to code it sensibly into your research practice. So taking that from the kind of personal perspective, it became most illuminating.
Mm. I mean, I was very struck when I was reading the work that you've produced around this about how you reflected on your position as part of a community, but quite silent in lots of ways. But the power of being there, being part of a community as a listener, was really striking.
Because that's for me also. We're a very talking oriented society in general. It's all about expressing ourselves, but it's not only through expression that we get the support that we can get. It's also about the presence. It's also about recognition. It's also about giving people possibility to see themselves through that environment, not necessarily show themselves, but also see themselves in what other people show. Yet, of course, I totally acknowledge that would there not be people who would like to share stuff in that page, that page would not exist, and that group would be devoid of people, and I, among other people, would be lacking of that kind of support line.
Have you've chosen this autoethnographic approach, which clearly has many benefits. This is a project which is interwoven with your personal life, the domestic sphere. Have you had any critique or any skepticism from other academics regarding the way you're approaching this research?
No. In that sense, this is still the academic environment in general is known for quite a lot of criticism and quite a lot of harsh approaches towards each other. And of course, the peer critique and peer review is an inherent part of what we as an academics do. This particular research, as it's not really published that much yet, is first of its kind for me personally, where I've also felt that my readers recognize the personal in this story. And whether they've been reluctant to criticize that because of that personality, or that they've recognized that through this personality voice or personal voice, this has really been able to draw on something deeper, and that sort of has enhanced the quality of this work, I don't really know. When I was doing the public talk for Malmö University in the Head of the Professor series, in that public talk, I end up using quite a lot of images from that group, which are actually all in response to my post saying, "Dear community, I have to do this talk. I think that best way to illustrate this talk is through the images from this group. And if you think that you would like me to use your child image, post in response of this picture." And that picture, that post had over 100 responses and images. So in already shaping up this talk, I ended up doing a new layer of analysis through that kind of image analysis and thinking about what else should or could I discuss using this rich resource that was just entrusted to me because of my autoethnographic sort of position. But then also able to look at those images only because of this positioning, self-positioning that I have.
And we can link in the show notes to the Mind of the Professor talk, because you share some beautiful photographs. Obviously, Facebook has had quite a lot of criticism recently due to issues of personal data usage and privacy. It's a huge multinational media corporation. Is this a topic of discussion at all within the group?
Nope. I don't think I've seen any posts about that. I was just thinking about when President Trump got elected, because his politics is also involved in changing the medical care system in US. There was one or two attempts to bring this up as a discussion point, but these were shut down. The post is not deleted. I think it still exists somewhere in the archives, but this was not of interest to anyone. Because this is a group that goes beyond politics, it goes beyond religion, although, again, being a very American, it's also very strongly religious in many of those posts, because people explicitly, for instance, asking for prayers for their children, but no one's specifying whom are you allowed to pray for. Again, in the moment of need, it doesn't really make sense to distinguish. I want this to be addressed to this or the other god. In that sense, the Facebook is also taken almost as a granted, as a sort of it's a platform. It's there. There is only one address to Facebook as a platform when again some kind of adjustments in Facebook post policy made that only text-based posts were not shown to as many people in their feeds. So people started posting more pictures with a comment, a non-related picture, or picture for attention, or picture for cuteness. So this became almost a format in posting the pictures, where the question was not necessarily related to what you could see on the image, but people recognized Facebook's affordance of that particular design feature that favored picture-related posts. But nobody's been explicitly addressing the issues about Facebook shutdown or issues about sense of personal privacy violations. Because I think that the idea of a closed group generates a certain sense of secureness. And again, in the closed group feed, you don't see ads as many, or you don't necessarily get confronted with the wild west realities of outside.
So this is a very important project. We're looking at shifting norms and addressing serious societal challenges. But have you changed doing this research? Has there been a change in the way that you experience the world?
And I think the short answer is yes and no to this question. Because again, I could not have taken this research on had I not been me in the beginning of it. It is because of my experiences, both as an academic and as a mother, that I'm thinking this research is at all possible. At the same time, if we take a theoretical framework and use this to scrutinize our everyday experiences, that scrutiny itself lends a certain analytical distance to our own everyday lives. I don't think that I've changed specifically for this particular project, because this is, to a certain extent, in my head, it's not even a project. It's an ongoing life experience. And therefore, I cannot say, okay, in the beginning of this project, and then I would like, what is the beginning? Is that the beginning of the 18th of February, 2013? Or is it the beginning of the project when I thought, okay, there's a call for papers, I'm going to respond to that. So this experience, this life experience has changed me, of course, substantially. But at the same time, the source of the change and the inspiration for the change, that's been inside me. I think, all the time.
And where would you like to see this project going? So digital parenting is a fascinating area of research. What's the next stage for you?
I'm taking this very slowly because, again, this is not a project as much as it is a life experience for me. So I'm going to follow the lead of my of the subject of my parenting experiments, or basically of my children, and I'm going to see to a certain extent where both the academic community interest and where their interest or focus takes me. Because digital parenting has led me to the discussion around social norms, for instance, in the sense of hearing or deafness norms. So it's opened up to me a fascinating world of sign language and related norms around that topic. It's also made me much more aware of my own sort of norms that govern my own behavior, norms around, for instance, what's expected of women as household caretakers, norms around evening meals or norms around healthy eating or norms around different kind of children-related activities. So in that sense, it's been an invaluable lens for me to explore the world of norms from different angles. Where it's going to take me, we yet to see. I hope that it's going to take me soon to discuss digital parenting, for instance, to other CHARGE community members in some forms or contexts, or not CHARGE, but other parents in different situations. So I hope that this kind of outreach moment that also this podcast gives me as a way of linking my experiences and linking my sense-making moments to other people as a paid forward lifeline that I got when my kid was born. I now feel strong enough to pay it forward to someone else in that same moments of both deep sorrow and joy of the first years of parenting of disabled child.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about your work. It's been fascinating to get to know you better through your work. So and thank you for taking the time to share with us.
Thank you for having me. I think that kind of sharing this talk or sharing this experience, the more I talk about it, the more empowered I feel also about the subject, and the more I hope that it reaches well beyond the academia and my immediate circles of colleagues. So thank you very much.